Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I'm joined by Connor.
Hello.
And I'm Josh. So what we're going to do today is we're going to split things up a little bit. Connor's going to talk about the case of Ted Bundy, both his crimes and his subsequent admirers. And then I'm going to talk a bit more generally about a psychological construct known as the Dark Triad. And we're going to be looking at how this maps onto psychopathy, and it might explain why many of these serial killers, who are clearly dangerous people, had many female admirers. And you think, well, that's really counterintuitive. Surely women of all people should be more concerned about their safety.
Risk averse, yeah. You'd think.
Mm-hmm. However, that doesn't seem to be the case in some women. I mean, I'm not making the generalization that it's all of them before I get some angry comments. But yes, there seems to be some sort of subset that makes some women more susceptible to attraction to very dangerous people.
Yeah, there's definitely the pathologized version of the I can fix him mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And that can obfuscate the moral culpability that many of these convicted killers who were sitting in the courtroom saying, all of all things, like, hail Satan, whereas the women were going, oh, you know, he seems mm-hmm. like a sweet guy. He seems superficially attractive. He's not the kind of guy that could actually kill somebody. So,
So to give you some examples, Jeffrey Dahmer, who committed the murders and post-mortem mutilations of 17 young men and boys, received love letters and gifts from women.
Despite him not being straight at all.
I know. Yeah, I was going to say it's wasted on him.
Have you seen the most recent Dahmer series by any chance?
No, I haven't.
Have you seen the backlash to it because Netflix tagged it LGBT content?
I did see that though, yeah. I'm sure we'll laugh quite a lot.
I'm sure we'll get onto why that's accidentally very telling in this segment.
Mm-hmm. So also there was Richard Ramirez, who was a serial killer dubbed the Night Stalker, as you may know him, who raped and tortured over 25 victims and caused the death of at least 13, and also married one of his many female admirers.
There's a Netflix series on him as well. Mm-hmm. There's a bit in there where they're discussing that women sent him nude Polaroids despite him sodomizing an 8-year-old boy. And there's this Hispanic abuela that comes on there that was part of the crowd that chased him down. And she just says, quote, "These are some of the dumbest bitches alive." And I thought, well, you said it best, love.
And more recently as well, Anders Breivik, the terrorist who murdered 77 people in Norway in 2011, which was mainly children as well, was reported to have received love letters from girls as young as 16, which is just crazy.
Disturbing.
To me.
Yeah. That's also a sickening shortfall in parenting there.
Oh, absolutely.
But I thought we should go through Ted Bundy as a case study because he's probably the most interesting as a man who could be outwardly perceived as charismatic, upstanding, able to competently ascend social hierarchies. Meanwhile, he was multitasking and moonlighting as a stalker, serial rapist, and serial killer. And I suppose we should have a disclaimer at the start of this to any audience members watching. Discussion of his possible competence, his intelligence, his characters which were perceived as charming or virtuous isn't going to lionize the guy, not to spoil some of his worst crimes, but he was a paedophile, a rapist, a necrophile, at some points possibly a cannibal, and killed about 36 women that we know of. So
he's got the degenerate bingo card filled out.
Yeah,
hasn't he?
Pretty much. He is, other than John Wayne Gacy, probably the most reprehensible American serial killer and the Green River Killer possibly imaginable. You've obviously already mentioned him in Contemplations 45. Mm-hmm. So this is that one with Harry is quite an interesting preamble to this. So anyone who hasn't watched that should go and look at it. And also I'd recommend just in the next video to watch, if you like this kind of true crime style content, my short free video on the website of John Wayne Gacy being compared to Drag Queen Story Hour, because there's a disconcerting number of similarities between both sets of face-painted clowns. But I can say that I'm glad to compartmentalize these kinds of killers, because I've done a quite deep study of Bundy, watching pretty much everything I can get my hands of, including the half-decent Zac Efron film as well, and reading this as part of it, which is Elizabeth Kendall's autobiography, Bundy's long-term girlfriend. Some really revealing stuff in here, but much like with the Gacy case, of which I kept having to do outtakes because I was enraged reading the list of victims, I'm quite glad to, even though we need to understand how these people operate in order to defeat them, that's a really important reason why we're doing this today. God, is it harrowing that people like this exist? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I kind of just want to put it in a drawer and never think about it again.
Part of the reason I didn't actually go into clinical psychology was that I thought that this is going to have a really detrimental effect on my like well-being. I'm not sure I can talk to people who are either pathologically dangerous or on the kind of flip side of that, really depressed and have had a really rough life. It would just have so much of an emotional toll.
Yeah, well, we'll take mention of Mindhunter at some point in the future, in a future podcast, but that was also one of your chief complaints about the Holden, the lead character, is you disliked the premise that you have to think like a serial killer in order to catch one. And it's useful to understand how they think and what some of the social factors that came about may be influencing their depraved crimes. But you don't need to send yourself to that dark place in order to understand how not to be one.
I would argue that it's entirely detrimental, in fact, in that if you think like a serial killer, then it's going to be harder for you to look at it objectively from the outside, because you empathize with the, well, empathize is not the right word, but you understand the thoughts and behaviors that are typified by these people, and therefore it becomes far more difficult to see it outside of your own interpersonal experiences.
Well, I can definitely say, especially with this, for example, and that's why the Efron film is quite interesting. Having watched it years ago, knowing nothing about the Bundy case, you initially think, oh God, they're railroading this guy. This book has Bundy's poetry, some of his photos taken by Kendall, a lot about her emotional experience at the time, going through the trauma of not understanding he was guilty and blaming herself for dobbing him into the police. And you do have to stop yourself sometimes being drawn in, lulled in by that Pied Piper call of, oh yeah, he is charismatic, he is an interesting person, and remember all of the awfulness that he did. And that's why I'm going to try and balance it here today to go through a sort of case study of his life, his crimes, and then also show some clips as to how he spun the media and created this, I wouldn't say myth, but this perception that he is a competent and virtuous person. Mm-hmm.
It's also worth clarifying as well that this is just my own kind of understanding of it, but a lot of the media depictions of psychopaths and serial killers make them far more sympathetic and understanding, because that makes good television. But in reality, if you see interviews with these people, you get the clear chills of, oh, this person, you know, I really want to stay away from them. Even just watching a video of them makes me feel uncomfortable.
It's quite interesting, because I don't think you always get that with Bundy. In hindsight, we do. But I remember there was the Amazon documentary with Liz Kendall. There was someone who remarked on this being the first televised trial in the United States, and he said it was obviously a made-for-TV trial. So the drama was really hemmed up, hence why it attracted the audience that it did, both outside and within the courtroom. But I'll go through his case history, and then we'll look at some clips, shall we? So Ted Bundy was born Theodore Robert Cowell on November the 24th, 1946. He was actually an illegitimate child. His mother gave birth to him in the Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers in Vermont before his grandparents adopted him, and his mother raised him with his stepfather later, telling Ted that she was his sister for quite a while. It wasn't until a cousin told him to seek out his birth certificate and mocked him as being a bastard child that he found out he'd been lied to. So that's an early onset trauma. The mother moved to Washington in 1950 to live with an uncle who was a music professor before his mother married Johnny Bundy, a cook in the military hospital nearby, and moved into a more working class neighborhood. The mother had told Liz Kendall on the flight home from Bundy's Utah kidnapping trial that she never told Ted about his adoption because she thought he had stuck his hand in the wedding cake and remembered it. Upon finding his birth certificate, she told Ted that his father was an unnamed World War II veteran who was in the Navy but never came back to visit. The man who was assigned on Bundy's birth certificate as his father, Lord Marshall, was a salesman and an Air Force veteran, but Bundy's mother made claims that she was seduced by a sailor named Jack Worthington, but after investigations were made, there was no record of anyone by that name in the Navy or in the Marine archives. An aunt has since suggested that his grandfather, Samuel Cowell, was also his father. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
No, lots of people don't. Lots of people have dug into his history and seem to explain this as a possible reason for his low impulse control, though I wouldn't suggest incest does explain away his, well, often myth-made good looks, but yeah, there are definitely some Chinatown-style vibes going on in this family, unfortunately. There are suggestions that Bundy was also possibly molested by his grandfather and his peers during school or scout camp outings, which might have skewed his sexual crimes later in life. At age 3, Bundy actually laid butcher's knives around his sleeping aunt while she was in bed. He also set tiger traps where one girl fell into them, and damaged her leg, and he would put the stakes down there like he's part of the Viet Cong and cover them over with vegetation. So he was using his time in the scout camps for particularly dangerous ends. Bundy was a boy and he enjoyed buying mice from a pet shop. Apparently his former defense attorney, John Brown, said he'd go into the woods and build a little corral and decide which ones to kill and which ones to let go. He sounds like the protagonist from The Wasp Factory. He doused a cat in lighter fluid and hung it from his backyard clothesline before burning it to death. And then later, he was bullied in high school for a speech impediment before going to the University of Washington to study Chinese. There, he seemed to break free of his chrysalis and evolve into a new social class. He dated a wealthy Californian heiress called Diane Edwards. Edwards called the relationship off later, sensing Ted couldn't get any further than what his bluff and bluster had got him into, and his subsequent victims all looked like his ex-girlfriend. They had long, shoulder-length brown hair, parted in the middle, white, about 17 to 24, other than Kimberly Leach, who was his youngest victim later on. He then moved from Seattle, Washington to Utah for law school and was baptized, of all things, into the Mormon Church. And later, 30 to 40 members of that congregation sent him a letter while he was in prison saying that they prayed for him and that he was definitely innocent. He then worked for Utah Republican Governor Dan Evans and was allegedly involved in Watergate. Of all things. He apparently worked for Donald Segretti, and he went in disguise to Democrat campaign events, quote, like a chameleon, to steal from the headquarters and spy on the opposition. He was even interviewed about this and played down his role, and he said, oh, I'm actually frankly embarrassed that all the media attention is on me. So he has a really strange place in political history. He was also living and killing in Utah, the Mormon Church then tried to obfuscate for his trial, saying that he wasn't guilty of Carol DeRonch, and lots of the women also made propositions at him.
Oh dear.
Yeah, so we're seeing how even in a close-knit community, that doesn't put many women off, particularly if you are perceived to be slightly nice. Speaking of his long-term female companion, the most notable one is obviously Liz Kendall, whose book I have beside me. She says that Bundy was well-dressed, spoke clearly with an almost British accent, and had an immaculate student room, could cook, and was beloved socially by her friends and family. She met him in 1969 in the student bar. Liz was a single mother. She'd had a high school sweetheart, then a short-term husband. She was a few years older than Bundy, and Liz, sympathetic though she is, considering she went through major trauma with Bundy, you can also see how he preyed on someone vulnerable, because Liz subjected her daughter to a carousel, both before and after Bundy, of short-term boyfriends who would come in and out of her life, and that was obviously partially due to her not being able to form long-term attachments, and that's clearly another marker that many vulnerable women can fall prey to men like Bundy, who have these psychopathic tendencies. Apparently, after 2 years together, Liz tried to pressure Bundy into marrying her. He originally had a marriage license and tore it up in an argument. She then facetiously suggested an open relationship, and Bundy said, well, I can't stop you from seeing other men, which made her incredibly jealous, and they had this on and off again dynamic. So
that is quite a manipulative thing, because him not caring, of course, is kind of suggesting, well, you can do what you want, I don't really care that much about you, which, of course, elevates his status, and if she's drawn to that, which it seems like she probably was, if she reacted in that way, then it's a way of guaranteeing her sort of dedication.
Yeah, cements the codependency, mm-hmm. Definitely, because the opposite of hatred is not love. The opposite of love is apathy, and so if he didn't reciprocate her emotional outbursts, she was an alcoholic, she was hit him a few times. She used to scream and cry during arguments. And apparently, according to her, other than one instance where he threatened her, he was very calm and rational in disagreements. Obviously, a very stark contrast with his violent outbursts and murders later on. She wasn't getting the emotional high that she needed to almost affirm her devotion, her insecurity. There's a passage from Notes from Underground that I covered with Nick, and it says about women who start arguments just to know their men still care. Liz very much came across as that. I'm not trying to criticize Liz here. Obviously, what she went through was horrific, but Bundy was very manipulative in not reciprocating her emotional advances, even though he was not very well emotionally contained himself later on.
It could be explained by just saying that, you know, he could have been a psychopath. He couldn't really form a genuine close connection. So it could be that he wasn't necessarily trying to manipulate her, but the effect was still the same.
He did actually say at one point that he had trouble forming relationships. So he's quite self-conscious of it. And so I have, I suppose, a working theory that wasn't necessarily always a facade to appear very controlled and cordial. he sort of struggled with it. Again, not excusing it, but there was a point actually. I believe it's. I can remember. I think it was page 121. If you just let me briefly flick to it, where he talks about it was after his capture. Yes, hang on a moment. He said, "Yeah." So when Ted had court dates in Salt Lake City, he said that being Ted Bundy in public was just too hard. If he relaxed and was normal, people said he was putting up a good facade to hide his weirdness. If he got upset and irritated with the press or the police, people said that he was evil. If he was jovial, people said that he thought the idea of murder was funny. So he could never really understand how his emotions fit. And he was always very conscious of the public perception of how he came across. Liz and Ted actually didn't have any kids. She got pregnant once and she then had an abortion. She blamed his career ambitions for the abortion. So that was another point of contention. He actually, during Christmas of 1973, was spending time with Liz and Molly Kendall and then disappeared and, without informing her, struck up a relationship with a woman named Susan, an ex-girlfriend, got engaged to her and then split up with her over an argument of abortion after Liz had aborted his child and flew back without ever telling Liz. So he had multiple women on the go. So again, it speaks to his ability to charm and disarm. Throughout his relationship with Liz, she also didn't really suspect this as a sign of psychopathy, but he stole things pretty frequently, like pairs of ski boots or all of her daughter's Christmas presents. Seems very impulsive. She said, "Oh, this isn't very becoming of a possible Republican politician. This could come back to bite you." There's actually a line in the book where she says, "I didn't have moral opposition to it. It was just I thought he would suffer from it his career down the road, but I didn't think that this was a sign of him being unstable." Yeah.
Right.
Very strange. And then the strange thing is as well, for someone who seems to be quite disconnected from his emotions, there are passages in here where you'd often like break down and cry in front of Liz, but it would seemingly be over menial things like, "Oh, I don't know if I can stay in law school." But then she later realized that lots of these outbursts where she mothered him and cradled his head and lulled him to sleep would coincide with the murder dates. So that suggests a hell of a lot of instability and possibly some more conflict and a weird amount of self-awareness. I mean, I've seen John Wayne Gacy, for example, and he showed zero remorse long after the killings, whereas Bundy at the time seems to be at least a little bit conflicted. Again, not excusing anything that he did. Speaking of the victims, he said confessed to killing 36 women. I suppose it's only apt or respectful that we actually read out their names, considering the story shouldn't be all about him. Linda Ann Healy, Donna Gail Manson, Susan Elaine Rancourt, Roberta Kathleen Parks, Brenda Carol Ball, George Ann Holkins, Janice Ann Ott, Denise Mary Naslund, Nancy Wilcox, Melissa Ann Smith, Laura Ann Aim, Carol DeRonch, who was kidnapped and not murdered, Deborah Jean Kent, Karen Aline Campbell, Junie Cunningham, Denise Lynn Olivetson, Melanie Cooley, the suspected, Lynn Dawn Culver, Susan Curtis, Margaret Elizabeth Bowman, Lisa Levy, and Kimberly Diane Leach. Survivors also include Yoni Lenz / Karen Sparks, depending on her pseudonym now. You can understand why she would want to change her name. Rhonda Stapley, which is contested because her story doesn't always add up. Karen Chandler, Kathy Kleiner, and Cheryl Thomas. The estimates, however, are about as high as 100, and Bundy didn't confess right until the last week of his life because he hoped drawing out the confession would get him off death row. He was actually confessing to murders as they were walking him down the hallway from his cell to Old Sparky in Florida. So we'll never know how many. Many bodies still weren't even found. He confessed to burying George Ann Hawkins' severed head, but they still didn't find the skull. So a lot of families won't get closure upon that. He apparently told State Attorney Ken Katsaris that by the time you catch the man who did this, this is back before he was actually convicted of any of these, he will be responsible for murders of women in the three digits in six states. And reminder as well, anyone who lionizes Ted Bundy as a charmer of women, his last victim and his youngest was Kimberly Diane Leach, who was 12. He snatched her from school. It was the same age of Molly Kendall at the time, who's reportedly, you know, the sort of surrogate stepfather of. And as when it comes to Molly, he actually played games of naked hide and seek with her when her mother was out the house. So again, the guy was just a paedophile. And absolutely evil. When his car was searched after a routine traffic stop in Utah for running two stop signs, they found a library of majorette magazines, so young girls in cheerleading outfits. So despite the sort of fetishism of him by the present, he, again, violent paedophile. They also found a bunch of burglary items, which is what he was originally charged with. A traffic violation, then possessing items for burglary, and then Carol DeRonch's kidnapping when he was picked out of a lineup. He was also suspected he was responsible for the murder of an 8-year-old when he was about 14. So that might have been his first. There's been some retracing here. A woman named Rebecca Morris has said, by age 8, Ted was killing animals. By age 14, when Ann Burr disappeared, he was prowling neighborhoods. peeping through windows and stealing. At age 3, he was putting knives around a sleeping aunt, and he was really delighted in that. And in 1987, Bundy had apparently offered a hypothetical confession and said he and Beverly Burr and Burr's mother were corresponding. He denied it in letters to her, but he did sort of hint at the fact that he might have killed the missing child. So he might have started this, you know, rampage of murder right from when he was really young. The reason he was so successful is he was actually luring women to his car fairly voluntarily. So he, with Carol Durant, she pretended to be an authority figure, a police officer, even though he was drunk at the time. With Janice Ott and Denise Naslund, he had a plaster cast on his arm. That's what inspired the plaster cast on Buffalo Bill's arm in Silence of the Lambs, for example, loading a sofa in the back. And then with Georgianne Hawkins, he was actually using a pair of crutches, which Liz spotted in his room at one point, and he just waved it away, and she didn't suspect it, even though it was a detail put out in the case. So he was often seen as either injured or just charming generally, and would invite the women back. Though there is some questions about his intelligence, of course, because when at the Lake Sammamish incident, where he abducted Naslund and Ott in the same afternoon, he gave his name as Ted to them.
Which seems pretty stupid to me to say, because of course he didn't know the ultimate outcome of that.
No.
And therefore he would be taking a risk, but then maybe he assumed that it was like a double bluff where he gave that name and therefore it's probably not that name.
Yeah, but in a very public park doing a, and this is what eventually brought him down, because Kendall saw the composite sketch and thought, oh my God, that looks like my boyfriend. I'll call the Seattle Police Department. If people in a public park are able to see you and overhear you introducing yourself as Ted, a sketch of your face and the name Ted is going to get you caught, and ultimately it did. So again, there are questions about impulsivity, intellect, all these things surrounding his sort of myth. Then there's the more disconcerting parts. Bundy also practiced necrophilia. He revisited the burial sites to observe the decomposition. He cut the heads off, he shampooed their hair, painted the fingernails of the bodies, and then sometimes kept the severed heads on him, and at one point burned the skull of one of them in Liz's fireplace and hoped she didn't notice, which is just awful. So yeah, I suppose we get onto the better news, where he was captured, detained, and prosecuted. As I said, he was originally just caught for a traffic violation in Utah before being put in a lineup, and Carol Durant picked him out almost immediately. His parents bailed him from jail, and Bundy then published an open letter in the press protesting his innocence, which was replied to with many supportive letters, including those from the Mormon Church. On October 1976, Bundy was charged with the murder of Karen Campbell and actually extradited to Colorado, because in Aspen, there was a ski resort. He was seen around there at the time, because when they raided his Utah apartment, they found gas receipts. They also found a hair in Bundy's car, and all of the, once they found Campbell's body, they found signs of struggle. So they thought, oh, the burglary equipment might have all added up there. So he was extradited on a first degree murder charge. He then escaped the Colorado jail because he decided to be his own defense attorney, and they let him have access to the law library. And so he just opened the window and jumped out, and he spent about 6 days in the wilderness, and then they captured him. Again, it was 8 days, actually. He then escaped the next Colorado jail, again, because he starved himself down to the point of where he could crawl through the light fixture and just fled to Florida. And he was on the run for a very long time, and that's why he did the ultimate killings, which brought him down at the Chi Omega sorority house, and also Kimberly Leach's abduction, because he fled to Florida, took the ID of a guy called Kenneth Meisner, who he originally posed as, and then broke into the Chi Omega sorority house to beat two women over the head with an oak log, beat up another two women and attempt their murder, and then beat another woman in a neighboring house afterwards.
Talking of matters of intelligence, you'd think that if he's just escaped two prisons or two jails, it is a difference. But you'd think he'd keep his head down, but apparently his compulsion seems to have taken over there.
Yeah, well, he actually once spoke to Liz and framed it in terms of her alcoholism. He said, just like you're an alcoholic, I have a sickness too, and I can't be around it. It being girls that looked very much like his ex-girlfriend as well. So seems to have been a sexual revenge fantasy in many respects. The one completely outside the norm is, of course, Kimberly Diane Leach, who he picked up from school having stolen a Florida State University van, abandoned the van near a pig shed, and they found her body later, which is just, it's inexplicable, and that's one of the ones he would never be able to talk about. Again, it just shows a completely irrational, evil compulsion. But those were the only murders he was actually charged with. So even though there was the Aspen case pending, he was only actually trialed for the two Chi Omega sorority house murders, the two other attempted murders, and Kimberly Leach's murder, which was much later, and he received three death penalties for those. It was actually the first court case to be televised in the US. The gallery was packed by about 250 reporters from five different continents. He eventually blamed his impulse to kill on porn and the EC crime comics at the time that were censored by the Comics Code because they were all women in bondage being cut up. And okay, I've read plenty of comics. It didn't drive me to that. I can actually agree with him possibly on pornography driving you to be more sexually depraved, but it doesn't make you a serial killer, I would say. He then told the prison warden, I've already covered that, I apologise. He often talks about the murders later to FBI investigators in the third person, and he told Stephen Mickard, who was an investigator, he was 99% a normal guy, but there was just this 1% that liked to bash girls over the head. Not particularly excusable, is it? But he was actually instrumental in later catching the Green River Killer with Robert Keppel and Dave Reichert, who partially Mindhunter was based on. So, after he was convicted for those killings, the trial and subsequent appeals against his death row sentences cost the US taxpayer $9 million. He filed a death row appeal on the grounds of ineffective provision of counsel, even though he was his own defense, by dismissing all of his other lawyers because he gave it drunk and then later mental incompetence. But at the time before, he had already said, I'm entirely mentally competent to do this, and it had been ruled on, so those didn't work. The most disturbing thing that was in favor of the mental incompetence one was at the Kimberly Diane Leach trial, he married his girlfriend on the stand, not Liz, who had abandoned him by then, but Carol Boone, another one of his flames, who had come to his defense and showed up all the trials and protested his innocence, who we'll see in footage later. As his character witness, after he'd already received two death sentences, and at the murder of the 12-year-old girl, he exploited a loophole where, in the presence of a judge, if you declare your vows, you can be married, de facto. And he just asked her on the stand as he was cross-examining her, do you love me? Yes. Will you marry me? Yes. And I hereby marry you. And the jury did not take too kindly to that, slapping him very quickly with a third death penalty, because that was obviously insane. Boone basically defended Bundy up until about a year before his death. She smuggled drugs into prison with him and even bribed a guard so they could have a conjugal visit and conceived a daughter with him. So he is survived by a daughter named Rose Bundy.
Oh, dear.
Yes, you can only imagine her life is... it's very difficult. He was executed on January 24th, 1989, via Florida's old Sparky electric chair. Apparently, he has one of the longest recorded execution times. He took 12 minutes of full current. And I assume it's because they didn't wet the head as well, so it must have been very painful. Everyone in the room said you could just smell burning flesh for ages. Female executioner actually carried out the deed, so that's quite a nice bit of irony, isn't it? So, during right before his death, he was assessed by a psychologist, and he had an interview with a preacher that was televised, which you can watch in the description. But the psychiatrist who said he suffered from split personality disorders and bipolar disorder after he was dead, even though his skull partially caved in because of the amount of current, they tried to look at his brain and assumed it just had some kind of chemical imbalance. They found completely normal, just like John Wayne Gacy. No lesions, mm-hmm. No injuries, no deformities. So it's just purely a personality problem or perhaps a voluntary choice.
It wouldn't be, if they didn't find anything physically wrong with the brain, it's just that there wasn't any brain damage to influence his behaviour. It doesn't mean that his brain necessarily functioned normally, because clearly it didn't.
Not. Yeah, but he had no injuries which exculpated him from it being some form of choice.
Because there are cases where people have got brain injuries that have changed their personality, and that's something that's really well documented, that if you have a physical brain injury, it can change how you conduct yourself. It's theorized, you know, Charles Bronson is in the Criminal.
Yeah.
It's theorized that a bottle to the head was what turned him violent before that point.
That's very interesting.
He apparently wasn't violent, although we can't really know. Can't go picking around his brain because he's still alive.
Yeah, well, Gacy tried to blame his killings on falling off a swing as a child, but again, his brain's in a jar in some Chicago psychologist's home, just floating on a shelf, and she said, yeah, there's nothing
wrong
there.
Psychopathic in and of itself, isn't
it? Yeah, it's very strange.
I would not want a brain in a jar anywhere near me, to be honest. It seems a little bit strange to...
Yeah, forgive the turn of phrase. It's not exactly a conversation piece. It's more of a conversation killer, because you wouldn't want to talk about it, would you? Now, all of that being said, and you can think, hearing all that, the cold, hard facts, how was Bundy, does he have this myth about being a charming guy, about being so unassuming, how did he get away with it? He did buck some of the trends throughout his life. Obviously, he had successful relationships, some were short-term, some were very on and off, like Liz, but he wasn't exactly unsuccessful with women, unlike John Wayne Gacy, whose characteristics of being very unattractive, overweight, utterly dislikable... People don't think he really is useful for the narrative that's being built in the present day particularly, and his affiliations to the Democrat Party are very politically inconvenient to talk about, of course.
But with actual clinical psychopathy. Not necessarily suggesting he's a psychopath, I don't know, but it certainly appears like it. But in the short term, they're very charming, but in the long term, people kind of figure them out.
Yeah.
So that's why they have difficulty sustaining long-term relationships. But in the short term, they can actually be quite successful, which seems like what's going on with Bundy here.
Yeah. There's an enforcement cost to your facade. It's like Piaget and Peterson built on it, the concept of equilibrated state. He talked about it in terms of countries, but you can have it in terms of personalities, of where the authentic individual or the free associative social order will win out over either a totalitarian state or playing pretend, faking it till you make it. Because in pushing yourself to be a certain way or compelling people to act in a certain fashion, to have an economic activity, there's an enforcement cost involved in force or in being, in pretending. So in the long term, Soviet Union, for example, loses out to the US, or in the long term, an authentic relationship loses out over a disequilibrated power dynamic with a psychopath. Yeah. But all of those things said, Bundy did do some things which meant he was unassuming. During his life, he had no instances of intimate partner violence, no prior convictions. He'd volunteered for a suicide hotline in 1971. He also volunteered for a rape and crime prevention project before law school to try and get commendations from academics. And there's a quote from actually his work experience mentor at the Rape Prevention Center from Falling for a Killer series on Amazon Prime. Quote, "I secretly hoped my daughter would marry someone just like him." Then in The Phantom Prince, in here, on page 198, Liz's daughter Molly recalls a story about how he chased down a purse snatcher at Northgate Mall and received a commendation by the Seattle Police Department. So again, he was seen as someone as a upstanding pillar of society. He also saved a kid from drowning. He revived a kitten from being stillborn for Liz's daughter. And then there's all sorts of quotes from the Falling for a Killer series, from even one of his Chi Omega victims who survived, Cheryl Thomas, who said, "He was such a handsome man with a future ahead of him. It's shocking. And his unassuming demeanor was how so many girls went with him." So he's bucking a lot of trends. That's why people are still interested.
Although, don't you think that perhaps some of his involvement in, for example, working on the hotline is to have an understanding of the crimes beyond committing them himself, in that it's sort of a socially acceptable form of academic study?
Yeah, possibly that's what has been suspected, especially because he had an academic interest in psychology as well. There's a bit where he was the sort of sole voice for hierarchy in the room, and this is where I suppose we should briefly address the contrast between Gacy and Bundy, and that both were involved in the party apparatus. Bundy even being involved in Watergate, whereas I think you can make the case for Gacy that Democrat policies are permissive of this kind of degeneracy and overlook these kinds of abuses, where, as obviously the Republican Uniparty are just as awful, but the Republican principles don't. They just simply attract power. Power attracts psychopaths, for example.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.